the organizers for this invitation. So what I'm going to speak about, so there's several parts of this talk, and they will have a different flavor. The statistical physics part is with Xiaofeng Ren, and there's some new work we're doing also with Xiaofeng Ren. And the more analytical stuff is with Giovanni Alberti and Felix Otto. So here's just a summary of the talk. So what I'm going to first have a little few slides on this type of material, which are synthetic materials, which are in some sense a paradigm for self-assembly. And then a nice mathematical formulation, which is simply the higher dimensional analog of the functional Aaron was talking about, which is in some sense a generic problem and a paradigm in itself for phase separation, but not the usual spinodal decomposition phase separation, but phase separation on a fine scale with oscillations. I'll explain what I mean by that. Okay, but before I start addressing analyzing that function, I'm going to talk a little bit about where the functional comes from, because I believe that's actually quite important, and talk about how you derive such a function from the microscopic picture. After that, I will return to a discussion of, I will talk about the analysis of scales and periodicity of minimizers in higher D, and what can be said without a priori assuming some rigid ansatz for the domain structure. And then I'll just show you, the derivation will reveal that there's lots of approximations made. So one can really ask, does this function really retain some of the essential physics? And I'll show you a very recent computation, which I think suggests that it does. And then I'll end with a very brief discussion on a new problem, which certainly is huge. Many people have discussed in the physics literature, but a new mathematical formulation for this copolymer-homopolymer blend. Okay, so first of all, what materials are we talking about? So a Dybok copolymer is a long molecule. It's a long molecule which you make in the laboratory by taking a long chain, a homopolymer of an A-type monomer and one of a B-type, and joining them together, grafting them together via some synthesis procedure, some catalyst or something. In general, these don't like each other, so you need some sort of enhancement to the chemical reaction. So when you have a lot of these, you have a system of a lot of these, what you typically see at a high temperature is a disordered state. But as soon as you lower the temperature, you have a phase separation. But it's a very different phase separation than a spinodal decomposition, which you would see in homopolymer blends. Why? Because these are connected, okay? And that connection is never severed. So the fact that these are connected means that you will get a phase separation on a small scale. And this is what we call microphase separation. So with this somehow framework of the connectivity, there's basically two driving forces behind this phase separation. One is that for low temperatures, the A and B monomers want to get apart from each other, so the polymer wants to stretch. But then that is counterbalanced by entropic forces, which limit the chain extension. So basically, these polymers prefer to be in their randomly coiled state. So here is a nice cartoon. Okay, so I'll warn you right away, this is a nice cartoon, but it's also a bad cartoon, because as you can see, these are much more complicated polymers than I'm going to deal with. I'm going to deal with diblocks. And right here, you can see a triblock. You have A, then you have B, and then you have A. But I think you can see the analogous picture if they were all diblocks. So what kind of structures you see? Well, this will depend, in this case, on the molecular weight. So for example, if the number of the white ones, let's say the white ones are B, are far fewer in the total macromolecule than the A's, you'll see some sort of spherical structure. Of course, when they're about the same, when F is about a half, you tend to see a lamellar structure. Okay, they're more complicated than structures than that, which I will get to in the next page.
Can the chains actually break up
during? No, they cannot. They don't. I mean, they don't. So.
What do you mean chain extension?
I mean, they're connected, but they want to get apart. Okay, so there's three material parameters, and this is important because I think whenever you're looking at regimes and everything, it's important to always put everything in terms of these parameters, and that's part of why we did that statistical physics derivation. So there's three material parameters. One is dimensionless. One is the index of polymerization, simply the number of monomers per macromolecule, which is typically very large, on the order of 50,000 or something. Chi, the Flory-Huggins Huggins, there should be an S there, interaction parameter. This is inversely proportional to temperature and measures the amount to which the A and B are incompatible, or thermodynamically incompatible. And then, of course, there's the volume fraction, F, the molecular weight. You can think of it as the total number of A's divided by the total number of monomers. Okay, so let's keep that up there. So let's look at this a little more carefully with the phase diagram. Okay, so here are two phase diagrams. The one on the right is an experimental diagram. The one on the left is a theoretical diagram. I'll come to how they derive this theoretical diagram in a second. It's basically Matson and Schick's PRL in 94. So what do we see? So on the horizontal axis, you see the molecular weight, the volume fraction. On the vertical axis is actually the product chi-n, which is extremely important. And that's what you see on the vertical axis. And then as we go from left to right, so here the A's are in the minority, here the B's are in the minority, we see a bunch of structures which increase in molecular weight. In particular, we see two interesting structures which are perhaps new to people who do spinal decomposition, which are these double gyroid structures. And of course, there are other structures which have been observed. These are the ones which are predicted in the experimental picture. So you also see a lot in the literature the notion of scaling laws. And an important scaling law is how the periodicity, the length scale of these structures, vary with the material parameters. And in the strong segregation limit, the strong segregation limit you can think of is when the interfaces are small compared to the domain size. One views an n to the 2/3 dependence. And this has been experimentally verified by Hashimoto and his group. And there are many, many ansatz-based derivations in the strong segregation regime. Okay, but let's just return to how one computes this diagram. Well, how did they do the theoretical diagram? Well, there's something called the self-consistent mean field theory, which is going to come up in the next few slides, whereby once you fix one of these ansatzes for your domain geometry, it allows you to compute the free energy with basically the phase distance, d, as your parameter, and then you can minimize with respect to d. And then when you can just compare the energies of those known ansatzes, you derive the free energy. And there's a very nice cover article in Physics Today, in fact that's where I got this picture from, of Bates and Fredrickson, where they do point out that whereas, you know, the theory and the experiment do agree very nicely, that one of the problems is that these are ansatz-based derivations. Okay, so in order to treat this, trying to get some results which are not ansatz-driven, there's a very nice formulation which came in a paper in 86 in Macromolecules by Ota and Kawasaki. So what is their problem? Well, okay, so I reformulated this problem in the language of Nishiro and Onishi, who I think were the first to bring this problem into some sort of mathematical community, which appeared in a paper in Physica D. So I write it in this their form. So U here is a relative monomer density. It's the density of A's minus the density of B's divided by the total. Total is 1. Okay, so what do we see here? So we see our Kahn-Hilliard part. So we have a gradient squared term, Dirichlet integral term, a double well energy which prefers U equals plus and minus 1. That's when it's A rich is 1, B rich is minus 1. Usually epsilon is some interfacial thickness. It's actually rescaled. This is a dimensionless form, rescaled interfacial thickness. But then we have another term. And this term, they claimed, is from the connectivity, and it is from the connectivity of the copolymer, from the fact that the two phases are connected, which is a long-range interaction term. Okay, they write it this way because of, well, when you write the Kahn-Hilliard gradient flow, it's very nice to write it this way. You can understand it just from this operator, or you can just write it out in terms of the Green's function, which is perhaps the Green's function for the minus Laplacian with Norman boundary conditions. These functions have average zero. Or the way it's convenient to think of this as the H minus 1 norm squared restricted to function L2 functions with zero mean. Okay, sigma, the parameter sigma was claimed to be proportional to 1 over n squared. Now, of course, you want to minimize this function over the constraint that the total average of U is fixed. That comes from the fact that you're incompressibility and you're always dealing with the same monomer type. So if you like, M is 1 minus 2F or something like that, where the F was from the old slide. Okay, so the important thing about this functional is that this term, so we have an idea, I think people have an idea of what these two terms do. But this term encourages oscillations. This is a term which, this negative norm is lowered by more and more oscillations. And the best way to see this is to look at it in 1D, and this was very nicely introduced by Aaron, so. So in 1D, what do we have? Well, in 1D, you have the nice fact that every function is a derivative of some other function. Every function has a primitive. So in 1D, let's take m equals 0, which makes it a lot simpler. There exists a primitive, v such that v dot equals u, which then, if we rewrite the functional in terms of v dot, so they are the first two terms, the third term becomes very simple. It becomes the L2 norm of the primitive. Okay, so if we want to lower this energy, this was essentially done by Aaron, how would we do it? Well, just take epsilon equals 0 for the second. If there's no surface energy, well, W means V dot wants to be plus and minus 1, so then you don't pay there. Well, if you oscillate, the more you oscillate, the more you lower the L2 norm of V, right? So a sawtooth function has lower L2 norm with oscillations. Of course, as soon as you turn on epsilon, epsilon is positive, you penalize such oscillations, and the effect is to set a fine scale. And Stefan Müller proved that for epsilon sufficiently small, minimizers are in fact periodic, and we saw other results pertaining to this, which are periodic, sawtooth-like, with a period epsilon with sigma to the one-third, and minimum energy scaling like that. So, of course, the question is, in higher D, what can you expect? So in higher D, it's probably unlikely that minimizers are periodic. But what can you say about them? So to what extent are they almost periodic? If this is a good model for that, for microphase separation, you'd expect periodic structures, because that's what you see. Scaling laws, et cetera, in higher D. A more interesting question, of which we can say almost nothing about, is what determines the structure within the period cell? For example, that gyroid phase. Okay, but before we talk about that, we have some physical questions. Does this functional retain the essential physics, and how is it derived? So there were several criticisms of the Ota Kawasaki model. It involved lots of assumptions and lots of approximations, which people said really weren't valid in the strong segregation regime. The paper is fairly hard to read, but it has a lot of ideas in it. And so Ren and I decided to rederive it from scratch and also connect it to this self-consistent mean field theory. So I'll just give you a little bit of that derivation, and the paper just appeared in Journal of Statistical Physics. Okay, so the derivation involves three steps. So I'm going to derive this. Okay, the derivation involves three steps. Okay, it's really the third step, which is the dangerous step, which is the step of Ota Kawasaki did. The first step is fairly generic. Okay, so now I want to model these polymers. I take n of them, little n of them, and eventually n gets very large. I take a thermodynamic limit. But say we have n of these little chains, which are continuous functions, and I equip the sample space of n of these continuous functions with some sort of Wiener measure. Okay, this is the Gaussian chain property of it. Now, it's written formally this way in the literature. I'll leave it like that. The only time we actually use it is when we use the Feynman-Koch integration formula, so I'll leave the formal way of writing it there, but that's basically our measure on our sample space. So now we have a sample space where things want to be nicely coiled as opposed to stretched. On that sample space, you introduce your interaction Hamiltonian. Okay, you choose this one. This is the simplest one. What you choose here will give rise to your double well energy. So we choose one, which basically now K and M always go either range over A or B. Okay, so and these are the interaction. For all purposes, it's VAB which is strong. VAA and VBB are very weak. In fact, the difference between those is chi. So basically, we just count the number of interactions. Okay, but it's a non-local thing. Somehow, if you look at one monomer, you have to get the energy of the whole system you have to, it's non-local in that sense. It's clear. But once you write down such a Hamiltonian, remember R is of n of these chains. You can write down the usual things of statistical physics, the partition function, the Gibbs canonical distribution, and the free energy. You can also talk about a microscopic field at X, given a configuration R. You just count the number of overlaps at X. Then you can rewrite the Hamiltonian as a spatial integral also with that. But once you have this, then what would you like? You'd like to average this macroscopic density over the Gibbs canonical distribution. And then you should get density, you should get the macroscopic. And that should tell you everything. Of course, the problem is due to this non-local interactions, none of these things are computable and none of this is tractable. So what you do is you approximate. So this is the self-consistent mean field theory. This is step two. Because there's many ways to explain it in the literature. This is the way we explained it. So basically, there's a variational principle underlying this. So if you take the true free energy, from here, you can approximate it by the following expression, where you take your Hamiltonian, but you don't average it with respect to that Gibbs canonical distribution induced from the Hamiltonian, but with respect to any distributions. Basically, if you minimize over all such distributions, you get back the free energy. S is just the entropy, the integral of d prime log d prime. Okay, the self-consistent mean field theory says consider those distributions generated by a pair of external fields acting on the A monomers and on the B monomers. There's no interaction. So you look at a Hamiltonian like this, which exclusively is some function on your Gaussian chain. Okay, once you have that, it induces these two. So basically, we plug those into there, and we minimize over all of the U's. So if you rewrite the free energy, this expression in terms of U, you get the following form. So what this is essentially is done is you have all these chains, and they're interacting. You pick one of your chains, you simulate the effect of all the other copolymers on this chain via some external field. Okay, well, why is this useful? Well, this is all computable now. Why is this computable? Because basically what we want to do is find given a U, we want to find expectations of U along certain Gaussian chains, which is computable. So let me just quickly show you one computation. So I mean this continuous function, which lives in a sample space where you equip some Wiener measure. Okay, yeah, that comes from, so I was hoping, that's this Kuhn statistical length. It comes from, I can show you, where it's a statistical physics thing, it's a standard thing. And this is the length scale. The Kuhn length scale is the length scale of the monomers. It's the smallest length scale of your problem. Okay, so for example, this quantity here, which was what? It was the microscopic distribution averaged with respect to this external field. Well, you can just write that in terms of these solutions to modified heat equations, okay? So they're modified because the field appears there. By the way, here it's critical that the thing is connected. This is a very important part of this calculation. So the self-consistent mean field theory stops here. Okay, Ota Kawasaki, following actually a paper which has most of the information in it, of Leibler in 1980, do this density functional theory. The idea of the density functional theory is to say, well, can we rewrite everything in terms of this? This is like my, unfortunately, it's like my U from the previous slide, not the external field, but the order parameter in that Ota Kawasaki energy. So can we write everything in terms of U? So the idea is, so we want to use this as the sole order parameter. So let's linearize the dependence of this quantity on beta U. But you linearize this at beta equals 0. And this is a problem. So beta equals 0. Beta is, as usual, 1 over the Boltzmann constant times temperature. So this is at, you're infinitizing at infinite temperature, which is not where you see the strong segregation limit. So you're potentially throwing a lot away. So you linearize this dependence, okay, linearize it through those calculations of those little q's, which was on the heat equation solutions, and then you invert the relationship. So it's fairly technical. Once you invert the relationship, you get, and make a few approximations, more approximations, you get something of this form, where the operator you get involves a Laplacian, involves a Laplacian to the minus 1. You do this all in Fourier space. Okay, so when you see, your basic term here is this term here. You can rewrite that in the form of this. So basically, when I put this into there, I integrate by parts. This is after you've taken some thermodynamic limits and thrown your boundary terms away, which seems to be standard. So when you do that integration by parts, you introduce this phi. So phi is my old u. I didn't call it u because I used my external field for u. Sorry about that. It's the density of the a's minus the density of the b's. Because of incompressibility, I only need one order parameter. You non-dimensionalize. You also divide by chi. Chi is the coefficient of, it basically comes from there. You get exactly this form where it's very transparent what epsilon sigma are. Okay, so this is your, that's your Kuhn statistical length, the smallest length scale in your problem. So it's dimensionless, and you get the following form here. You also get, the volume fraction also comes here, which surprised me at first, but no, that's standard, and that comes in there. And clearly, of course, sigma is proportional to 1 over n squared. So this allows you, for instance, then whenever I talk about epsilon to the 1/3 over sigma to the 1/3, that is exactly chi to the 1/6 and to the 2/3, which is your scale you expect. So, all right. So I know that was fast. I just wanted to give you a flavor of how a derivation like that goes, particularly because it was completely new to us. Okay, so let's go back now to your... So now I've done a whole bunch of things. Originally here, sigma is your sample size. So you've non-dimensionalized to a unit domain. So now I'm going to call my non-dimensional unit domain omega again. I'm going to call my order parameter u, and that's basically my functional. So I want to minimize this where? Over u and h1, the mass constraint, and I want to consider this parameter regime, which if you write in terms of chi and n is the natural parameter regime, to consider in this strong segregation regime. So I want to first look at scaling and periodicity of minimizers. So I already mentioned that there's been some results in this. Well, clearly there's Stefan Müller's result. M not equals 0, so you can think of it as non-symmetric well, is actually more subtle, and Nishiro and Nishi first tackled, but the best results are Ren and Wei's results of recently. I should say that the 1D arguments mostly follow from the type of arguments Aaron was using via the Euler-Lagrange, or, well, he didn't, not only those, but Euler-Lagrange and also Kahn-Hilliard dynamics, which is, you can think of as UT written this formally, but it's, or gradient flow with respect to H minus 1. Okay, it's very natural to consider the Kahn-Hilliard dynamics, in particular because if you think about it, the non-local, especially this way you write, the non-local term becomes a zeroth order term in the equation when you look through the Kahn-Hilliard dynamics. It's actually, so generally codes which work well for Kahn-Hilliard can be modified. Okay, I want to look at higher D. So in higher D, analytical results, I'm not going to use these or a Lagrange equation. Typically, PDE results in higher D are difficult to work with. I'm going to talk about some direct methods. Of course, computational, the computational stuff one does via the Kahn-Hilliard dynamics. Okay, so what can one say in higher D? Well, first of all, scaling laws, first thing. So scaling laws can be understood, just scaling laws in terms of either the period or the energy done in the literature can be understood via what's called domain theory. In domain theory, one sets an ansatz. So the simplest ansatz you could think of would be 1D lamellar periodic structures with 1 degree of freedom, let's call it A, and then minimize with respect to A. So in this context, I have my energy, it depends on some material parameters, and A, because that's the only degree of freedom. So it's in some sense one-dimensional. If I rewrite the energy in terms of the scaling which you expect, then what's in the remainder, I can simply take a derivative with respect to A, set it to 0, in other words, minimize this, and show that in my parameter regime, this scales like 1. In other words, it's independent of your material parameters. And you can find that A opt is epsilon to the 1/3 over sigma to the 1/3. So this is what I mean by an Ansatz-driven scaling law. And you recover the n to the 2/3. Okay, so what can we do if we don't assume an Ansatz? So this is the simplest little result you could get. Well, one is to follow these things, but now don't make any Ansatz on U. So let U be any H1 function. Renormalize the energy. When you renormalize the energy, what do you get? Well, you get a weighted sum, first of all, of the H minus 1 norm squared. That's the non-local term. If you write it out in Fourier decomposition, you'll see it's exactly that, where you divide by chi squared. And then this term, which is very familiar to people in calculus of variations, somehow this for epsilon small is essentially a BV norm. These weights reflect exactly the scalings of the natural scalings of the spaces. So they're not that important. They might as well be one. You can scale them out of the problem. Essentially, what do I have here? I'd like to know, is this BV norm plus this H minus norm squared bounded by some fundamental constants? So this idea came up in Bob's talk this morning. So the new idea basically, well, is to use somehow interpolation inequalities, which appeared in our paper in Communications and Math Physics a few years ago. And this allows you to get matching upper and lower bounds for the energy. Now here I didn't put M in. But if you did put M in, you can do it and you can find the optimal behavior in M is 1 minus M times 1 plus M. Okay? And that's achieved by spherical. Okay, this scaling is not so important because the minority regimes are hard to access for obvious reasons. Okay, but what more can you say? You certainly would like to say much more. So how can we get further evidence? Where are we? Search for further evidence of the fact that further rigorous support for the fact that in higher D, minimizers for CP are almost periodic structures on the scale which has been postulate and which has been experimentally verified. So there's this idea, this blow-up idea. Initially, we got this idea from a paper of Giovanni Alberti and Stefan Mueller, but in the end, it's very different kinds of arguments we need. Theirs was based on Young measures, which were nicely suited to one-dimensional. That was all 1D. So suppose you take a sequence of minimizers on omega. What do you expect? You expect for epsilon small, they're getting more and more periodic. So what you do is you take a macroscopic position in your material, say S equals 0, and you blow up on the scale, epsilon to the 1/3 over sigma to the 1/3. So T you can think of as a microscopic variable. What do you expect as epsilon go to 0? Well, if they were truly periodic, you'd expect essentially in the end you'd get structures which are on a scale of 1. Because doing this limit, you focus on the scale epsilon to the 1/3, and you remove all finer structures, finer scales. So in particular, you make the interfaces sharp. So we'd expect that in the end, the minimizers converge to periodic structures on a scale 1. Okay, so how can we put this in a precise framework? Well, one is you consider the asymptotics of the rescaled energy. You know how to rescale the energy by the scaling law. You know that that's the term you have to factor before you let epsilon go to 0. Rescaled energy of the blow-up. So you write the energy in terms of these, in terms of the microscopic variable T, and you look at its gamma limit. Then you look at, somehow with some compactness, you prove that local minimizers, now what do I mean by local? I mean local with respect to compact perturbation of the copolymer functional converge to local minimizers of the gamma limit on compact sets. And then you'd like to prove something about minimizers of the gamma limit, because these two together will tell you that for epsilon small, these look like minimizers of the gamma limit. Okay, so what we can prove is a uniform energy distribution for local minimizers of the gamma limit. So at least from the perspective of energy, things are localized on the scale 1. So this is a little bit technical. I just want to give you one slide which shows the essential result, essential ideas. Okay, the first is when you do this blow up, your domain size is going to go to infinity. So you have a lot of problems. So in particular, what happens to the boundary conditions? How do you localize this non-local energy? The way to localize it is very natural. It's to replace that non-local energy, so that H minus 1 norm squared, So this is, in some sense, we're doing the analog of the 1D toy problem. We're replacing it with a primitive. Now you could say a function of several variables doesn't have a primitive. No, but it has a B, a vector B, such that the divergence of B is U. So there's a simple variational principle which relates this, assuming we have some boundary conditions for B, to the H minus 1 norm squared, which I can easily show you afterwards. It's just the simplest elliptic variational principle, Laplacian. So once we do this, we get a limit functional. So this is what the limit functional looks like. So there's no surprise that we get a BV norm. So U is a function in BV which takes only values plus and minus 1. Then we retain the non-local energy. So what we do is we look at the energy averaged over the average energy on large and large domains. Now you could say something like, wait, this is only equal to the H minus norm squared when we have some boundary conditions. The boundary conditions don't matter as L gets larger. And how do we actually show that? We consider two admissibility classes. So in the first class, U is in BV. Little b is just any L2 vector field such that divergence B is U minus M. Okay, it's important. We need the flexibility of doing this for any M. The second class is where you do all of this, but you assume the Neumann boundary conditions, in which case minimizing over all Bs gives you exactly the H minus 1 norm squared of U. Okay, our theorem is exactly that sort of uniform energy distribution. It takes a little bit of time to see why this has anything to say about the problem, but I think it does. So that there actually exists something, it depends continuously on M, such that as L gets large, this is basically a sigma M plus little o of L. It disappears. So what it's saying is that for epsilon small, minimizers are actually, at least from the point of energy, the energy is distributed evenly, very evenly, because you have the same constant on the scale 1. Okay, so I know those two are a little bit technical, but let's now forget about the analysis and come back to a very valid question. Was, okay, so essentially all of these scaling laws just confirm that the structures live on this scale. They don't even prove it, but they confirm that the structures live on that scale. You might say, but when you do that linearization about infinite temperature, you're throwing away a lot. So the first natural question is to say, well, within a period cell, what can you say about the geometry? Okay, theoretically, that's very difficult. Numerically, what I wondered if somebody could use this and simulate the double gyroid phase. And that's exactly what Nishura, Teramuto and Nishura recently did. And actually, Osa told me that he's actually also simulated this gyroid phase entirely from those Kahn-Hilliard dynamics in 3D. So this is just one of their pictures. This is an experimental picture. This is one of their simulations. They have several, you'll find in that paper. So at least that tells me that that's actually surprising, because that's something you don't see in Kahn-Hilliard. So somehow, the internal structure of these cells, the non-local term plays a role too. Okay, so that's just some evidence. So I have some time. So let me talk now a little bit about this copolymer-homopolymer blend. Okay, so before we just had a mixture of dye blocks, A and B. And so what we saw is this microphase separation. And we did some statistical physics, and we proved some abstract theorems about the scale of them. Now suppose you have a mixture. For simplicity, I'll assume that the polymerization index is the same, where you have A and B dye block, and you have C. So C could be A or B, or it could be some different species, a homopolymer. Okay, so suppose you make a mixture and you lower the temperature. Then what do you see? You actually will see, as long as the concentration of C is sufficient, I'll assume that the concentration of Cs is the same. There's half as many homos as there are dye blocks. You see actually macrophase separation, where you have homopolymer-rich domains and copolymer-rich domains. And then you have followed by microphase separation within the copolymer-rich domains. So you introduce another scale. So recently I found the paper of Ota and Ito in 95 in PhysRev E, which basically wrote down, again, their non-local functional in this context. Of course, they gave no details. So they just simply said a similar calculation as we did in that paper in 86 gives this. So one thing Ren and I are doing is trying to derive this. In particular, they didn't give any information about what W should be or what the how the parameters are. But they proposed the following model. Okay, the model looks a little bit strange. You might expect that there'd be non-local. So there's two order parameters here because of conservation of mass. So the density of A's, density of B's, density of C's. So one is the old one, the density of A's minus the density of B's. So phi is good for the microphase separation, microphase separation regime. And then so phi and C actually is a good parameter to measure the macrophase. So they write everything in these two parameters. It's actually more natural, I think, to write it out in rho A, rho B, and rho C separately. And in that case, you see that there's no non-local effects in rho C. In this case, you get non-local effects in everything, except for when this mysterious case when NA is equal to NB, and then they disappear. So that would be when the A's and B's are the same length. Okay, so it has the same formula. So the same general feature, you have some double well energy plus some gradient square energy. This is before the non-dimensionalization. And then you have this non-local interaction part, which involves interactions between the phis and the C's. As usual, you take away the average. Okay, this is exactly the old one. If you rewrite this in terms of little f and n, you get exactly what we got before. But then there are these new two things here. So this is a little bit complicated, and I'd be interested when the derivation is finished. But there's a nice simple toy problem which you can play the same game. So for this toy problem, let me simplify things by taking f equals a half, so NA equals NB. Now let's take the interaction parameters all the same. So let's just pretend they're all the same. And let's take the amount of rho C to be equal to the amount of die blocks. The amount of C's to be equal to the amount of die blocks. In other words, C bar equals a half. And let's take the simplest W, which has zeros only at the pure phases. So it's zero when it's entirely C-rich, zero when it's entirely A-rich, and entirely B-rich. Then let's work with the primitive variables again. So let's introduce little v and little w such that v dot equals phi and w dot equals c. Again, take your simplest well energy, which has zeros exactly on the pure phases. So you can just see that there's zeros exactly on that. Well, if we write down the energy, we simply get this simple toy problem here, where that's your W. I mean, if you play with this, you can really it's fairly easy to be pretty sure that this is what the minimizer looks like. So there's your macrophase separation are from 0 to 1 half, 1 half to 1. So here is C-rich. Here are the A-rich, B-rich. So basically, there's three scales here. There's three scales here because there's the macrophase O of 1, the microphase, which is O of epsilon 1/3, and all interfaces here are O of epsilon. So as a conjecture, you might like to know whether or not that is, in fact, the minimizer. So that sort of ends my talk. So I really think this copolymer functional is a very nice functional to look at in multi-D. But I also think that you have to have close attention to the statistical physics. And I think there could be a lot of work done at that level to derive other types of density functional theories. So in particular, I'm thinking now of one with Chun Liu, where we model, instead of looking at Gaussian chains, you have Hookean springs, which simplifies a lot of the calculations. I don't know if it'll come into anything. So I'll maybe end there.